I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama will release a declassified report today on intelligence failures in a suspected Christmas Day plane bomber plot. And Obama's National Security Advisor James Jones is predicting Americans' response.
Well, I think once people read it, I think there's a certain shock to it in the sense that the man in the street will say, will be surprised that these correlations weren't made.
General Jones speaking to USA Today, and Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Susan, hearing that, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking more shocked than we already are, you know, that someone got on this plane paying with cash, no luggage, that dots weren't connected. What more do you know about what he meant?
You know, I think that there are some details that we don't know yet that we'll find out when this report comes out at about 3 p.m. this afternoon. General Jones indicated, of course, there are some things we do know about the father going to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria, for instance, and warning that his son was becoming radicalized. But I think there are some other clues that were missed that we haven't heard about that we'll know about this afternoon, and that they just add up to a very dismaying portrait of an attack that could have been avoided.
Do you know, is it human failure, system failure? Has he told you any more?
He said that the good news is that it's not the kind of systemic failure that's going to prompt the sort of whole-scale overhaul of intelligence operations that we saw after the 9/11 attacks. But instead, he said that what's needed are tweaks. And when I asked him what examples of that might be, he said, for instance, the need to hire more analysts. Some of these analysts that are watching these clues come through and trying to pick up on them and decide which ones are red flags and which ones are red herrings, that they're overwhelmed and there may be a need to hire more people for the intelligence agencies. And he said, that's something we can do and that's something we can fix.
Well, that sort of leads us to the other big news today. An administration official has confirmed that U.S. border security officials had planned to question the Nigerian student, the alleged Christmas Day plane bomber, when he landed in Detroit. They'd seen the red flags after scrutinizing the passenger list, which they only got once the plane was in the air. So they knew he was on the plane, and they were planning on detaining him in Detroit.
Boy, cold comfort for the 300 other people on that plane, right?
Yeah.
That he would have been pulled aside at the time they landed. Well, I think that's the kind of thing that General Jones was talking about that are really going to grab Americans' attention when we hear about it. And could cost people their jobs. The White House has not ruled out the idea that some officials may be fired over this incident.
Well, and I just want to have said to the Detroit thing, at least one arm of the system, though, did work. In other words, somebody looked at that manifest. Now, of course, the criticism will be how come someone's not looking at it before someone gets on a plane? But at a certain point, they knew he was coming to Detroit.
Well, that's true, but it does seem a little belated, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
That you have someone who may have that you might suspect of terrorism, and you let him get on the plane, you let him make a connection in Amsterdam, and you're going to pull him aside when he gets to Detroit. With the benefit of hindsight, which, of course, is always 2020, that's too late.
Yeah. What steps is Obama expected to announce later today as a result of this report?
We don't know. The accurate answer I should give you is that I don't know what Obama will announce this afternoon. But what we think he'll do, given clues from General Jones and from Robert Gibbs at the White House briefing yesterday, is he'll announce some very specific steps that are being taken to try to tighten the system. One of the things we're going to be looking for is whether there'll be a decision to make it easier to put suspects on that no-fly list. If this guy had been on the no-fly list, they say he would have been intercepted before he was had gotten on the plane.
As opposed to being on the very long watch list.
As opposed to being on this very, and of course there are several watch lists with thousands and thousands of names. The standard to get on the no-fly list has been pretty rigorous, and there is some considerable discussion now about making it easier to put people on the no-fly list with a lower standard of proof that they might actually be trouble.
Well, ABC News is also reporting a preliminary plan to surge federal air marshals and put them almost exclusively on overseas flights flown by U.S. carriers. Did General Jones tell you about that or anything else?
No, we did not talk about the use of air marshals. And I did see that report on ABC. It makes it makes some sense given that that we are constantly adjusting what we do because of threats and incidents we have. But I'll tell you something interesting. I had breakfast this morning with some other reporters, with Lee Hamilton, who was co-chair of the 9/11 Commission and is a member of the President Obama's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And he made the point that, look, the United States is now really looking at this Christmas Day bombing for what went wrong and how to fix it. He said Al-Qaeda's looking at it, too, to figure out what went wrong, why didn't the bomb go off, what could they do differently next time to make this a successful attack. And that is really the challenge when it comes to dealing with terrorism.
Yeah. Well, we understand that General Jones also told you that the attempted bombing and the Fort Hood shootings prior to that were two strikes, and the Obama administration is, you know, wanting very much to avoid strike three. Both those events, the plane event and Fort Hood, have been connected to the U.S.-born Virginia cleric who's now in Yemen. Each of those alleged suspects had connections with that cleric. Is he being seen as the new Osama bin Laden?
You know, I think that General Jones was making a slightly different point, which was in both these cases, their red flag should have been acted on before something happened. In both these cases, it's not defensible that the attack and the attempted attack were allowed to go forward because there were enough clues, enough obvious clues that should have been picked up on. And that whole language, one strike, two strikes, you know, it could be a kind of warning, implicit warning to heads of some of these agencies that these kinds of lapses are not going to be permitted.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
From the war on terrorism to the war on cancer, which was first declared by President Nixon in 1971, today we want to ask, how is it going? Nobel Prize-winning biologist James Watson wrote recently in the New York Times that beating the disease is now a realistic ambition, but he doesn't know anyone working on weekends because they don't think they have the cure. And overall, death rates have fallen, but cancer took 560,000 lives in 2006. That's 200,000 more than the year before Nixon's declaration. And of course, if it's just one life and it's someone you love, it feels like a battle lost. Let's go to the front lines with Dr. Jerome Groopman of Harvard Medical School and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. You might remember his latest book is How Doctors Think, and when we interviewed him about it, we were flat on our backs in your office, Dr. Groopman, because your back had gone out. It's nice to see you in a chair.
Terrific to be here.
So, to start with your thumbnail, where are we overall?
Well, we've made progress, and we've reduced the death rate. A lot of it has to do with changes in lifestyle and medication. For breast cancer, for example, now that we know that estrogens are not the cure-all for women after menopause, that appeared to be promoting breast cancer in women. And there are some new drugs, but we still have a far way to go before we can declare victory.
Right. And when you say the death rate has dropped, overall it has, and more people have died because there are more of us. The population has grown so much. But let's just so start at the beginning. Do we know more about what causes cancer? We had the amazing Human Genome Project in 2003 mapped things out. That told us a lot genetically. But what else do we know about what causes cancer?
Well, we know that those breaks or mutations in the genes in cancer cells can be caused by environmental toxins, chemicals in the environment, radiation exposure. But we really don't know in most people why one person develops cancer and another doesn't.
Right. There's a very interesting study, for instance, to show if a blow to the breast or surgery or an infection can actually spur cancer cells.
Well, there's a lot of interest in the relationship between inflammation and cancer, where that might actually promote, again, what are called free radicals, oxygen molecules that damage the DNA and could potentially lead to cancer.
Yeah. Bacteria, virus, you know, that's all still in the pot. You know, what is the cause? What are the causes?
Right. Most of them don't seem to be infectious, but certain cancers like cervical cancer are clearly related to viruses that infect women, and we know which viruses those are. And indeed, a vaccine was just developed, which seems very effective and hopefully will protect the next generation of young women against these cancer-related viruses.
And remember that point when we get to cures, because some people say, well, if you can do that, why can't you do it for all cancers? So hold that thought. But what about detection? We had all these recent controversies about screenings, and then we found out that we're not all getting the same kinds of screenings or the same levels of radiation. In fact, we're hearing that it's, you know, varied across the country. But just stay with the idea of early detection. Do we know that that's leading to a drop in death rates?
That appears to be certainly the case for cervical cancer with pap smears in older women, certainly the case in terms of mammograms for women 50 and above. Mammograms in the 40 to 50-year-old range does save lives. The question is, what are you trading off? And it's a very complex and individual decision for women to have the anxiety of a mammogram, to have a biopsy, and so on. Most women I know are willing to have that for the idea that you could catch a cancer and potentially save their lives.
Right. And as when we discussed this, when this was in the news, one of the advances is that we now know that there are as many as 20 different kinds of breast cancers, and some of them, you know, appear as tumors and such, but you can live with them your entire life.
Right. So some of them appear to be relatively slow growing. Others appear to be very aggressive. For some, we can distinguish, but unfortunately for the majority, we still don't have the tools where we can say, don't worry about this one, or that one really needs to be found early because that could save your life.
And what about treatment? Dr. Stephen Edge of Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo says, it's scary how much variation there is in cancer treatment across the U.S.
I think that's true. There are still areas of the country that don't give cutting-edge treatments. It's also still true that most of the large academic cancer centers have the newest experimental drugs. On the other hand, many outstanding cancer specialists, oncologists, have been trained and are now in the community. And the National Cancer Institute is trying to set up programs to bring cutting-edge treatments to every community in the country. The worst care, unfortunately, is in the minority and poor areas. They are really underserved in terms of cancer treatment.
And you know, just it's an uncomfortable subject, but a lot of this has to do with money and where the money goes.
A lot of it has to do with money and the fact that people don't have coverage, that Medicaid pays very poorly. And one hopes, although I'm not confident, that some of the reform measures will improve this.
We're talking with Dr. Jerome Groopman about just where we are in the war on cancer. And just before we take a break, one of the exciting treatments, at least for a while, was angiogenesis, cutting off the blood supply to the tumor so that it can't grow. That was, you know, really big headline in the 90s. Where are we there?
Well, that's made some improvement. Again, you choke off the blood supply to a cancer. This was Judah Folkman's work. But initially, not Judah, but others said this is the cure. And there was a front page article in the New York Times. And it like everything else, it's helped certain cancers, and extending life for months to a year or two, but it's not a panacea.
Okay. Well, again, we're going to continue to get a report card on the war on cancer from Dr. Jerome Groopman of Harvard Medical School and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. When we come back, Doctor, I want to talk about, what about the idea of a pill? You know, if we know some of the drivers in cancer cells, why can't we target them? We'll do that in 1 minute after a break here and now. Welcome back. We've been getting a report card on the war on cancer, even as we've learned more and more about the disease, including that very often cancer is more than one disease. Victory has been elusive, except in a few areas. With us is Dr. Jerome Groopman of Harvard Medical School and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And I mentioned earlier Nobel Prize winner James Watson, who's out in Stony Brook on Long Island. And he writes that, yes, we now know that there are genetic drivers in a cell. They drive the cancer. And you may be able to get a drug to fight one driver of one cancer, let's say Herceptin in breast cancer. But until that drug can be given in combination with other drugs that can get all the drivers, it just keeps – the drivers can keep mutating. And that's the only way to get a cure. Your thoughts on that and why we aren't closer to a cure for most cancers?
Well, he's right to some degree, and that is that there are multiple parallel pathways. There are multiple drivers working together in a cancer cell. And you need to put combinations together, and that would be more effective. And that's being done now. It's slower than all of us would like because of regulatory hurdles and so on. But on the other hand, cancer cells are just terribly diabolical in terms of how clever they are. That not only do they have mutations when you begin to treat them, but they develop new mutations mm-hmm. as you're treating them. So it's almost like that Greek god Proteus, that you'd grab hold to one arm and he would sprout out a new one.
Right. But where have there been successes? Where are death rates going down? Where are they going up?
Well, what's going down, breast cancer for sure, that mainly, as we said earlier, seems to be related to estrogen use, although Herceptin is helping a certain fraction of women.
The blocker.
The blocker, the targeted therapy. Certain drugs for lymphoma, a drug called Rituxan, is really improving the cure rate, it appears, for very aggressive lymphomas. On the other hand, we haven't had much progress at all in lung cancer or really in melanoma, which is increasing in melanoma is.
Well, and how much of this has to do, the overall, report card on the war on cancer, with the way the battle's been fought? Some people don't like that phrase, so I'll say that right now. Some people think, no, we're not at war. They're trying to be peaceful about their approach to ridding cancer, and I want to respect that. But, some people, there's a raging debate about where the money went. Again, James Watson said when he was on the first task force, he said, let's put all the money in research right away. Instead, it went into clinics. Part of the current debate is that it's gone into the last few moments, months maybe, of a cancer life as opposed to into finding a cure. You've called this, I think, the iron lung syndrome. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well, it meant that instead of looking for an innovative vaccine for polio, it was as if you were investing in just more iron lungs. You were taking care of symptoms rather than getting at the root cause or protecting the person. I think in the initial Nixon war on cancer was really fraught with huge sums of money misspent and really wasted in both looking for viruses as the cause, which turned out not to be the real cause, and also Me Too studies, really very mundane studies of different chemotherapy drugs, which didn't advance things in the least. For sure, we need more basic science research right now.
But, that is the hardest thing, because who isn't going to want, when it comes to your loved one in the last few months, and even when it may not help, that's where you want that money to go, to try.
Right. And I'm an oncologist, and I take care of many people. And I believe that, sometimes you try and you gain very important time. My mother died of breast cancer about a year and a half ago.
I'm sorry.
And the last months of her life were tremendously improved by receiving drugs, some of them experimental, which really improved the quality of her life and was, invaluable to us. I think as a society, it's still worth investing in those kinds of people and at that time of life. There are other moments, though, where an intelligent and compassionate discussion can prevent people being kept on respirators and an intensive care unit beyond any hope when things really are futile.
Well, and we're also talking about institutional leadership, where the dollars are directed. And we heard an anecdote from you that is going to stun some people. About, a lot of people try to do prevention and feel more money should have been gone into should be going into teaching mm-hmm. people about prevention, although if you don't really for sure know all the causes, that's difficult. But a lot of people feel intuitively, I know that it's toxins, I know that it's this and that, and I know I can protect myself with vitamins. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's probably one of the most overturned conceptions in the last few years. Prostate cancer, for example, vitamin E and selenium was supposed to protect against prostate cancer. So a placebo-controlled, very rigorous scientific study showed that it had no benefit at all. Vitamin A, which we get from carrots and so on, was supposed to protect against lung and throat cancer. It turned out it promoted lung and throat cancer. People develop more cancer by taking high doses of the vitamins.
Why? Why?
Probably because we, in our diet, get what we need in terms of the levels of vitamins just by eating healthy. And cancer cells that grow very quickly, they love vitamins because it feeds their growth. So there's a huge industry claiming that vitamins cure cancer, and there's almost no scientific data to support it.
Well, that will be something for people to chew on. In the meantime, again, we've had all these disturbing reports about to do, what to do, what not to do. Give me one bottom line, you, an oncologist, what people should do.
In terms of a lifestyle?
Yeah.
I would say, first of all, smoke, obviously primary smoking
stop.
Or secondhand, absolutely stop. I also think that women who are beyond menopause should be very careful in terms of taking estrogen or how long they take estrogen. And I think that a really good physical exam, and I still believe that colonoscopy, mammogram, pap smear can really save lives.
Dr. Jerome Groopman, again from Harvard Medical School and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, author of What Doctors Think. We just heard what you think, and we appreciate your opinion so much. Thanks, Dr. Groopman.
Great to be with you.
All right, still ahead today, I'm sure you want to hear about this, Doctor. Snowboarders are rushing to master a move that just seriously injured one of the best in the sport right before the Olympics. We'll get the latest on Kevin Pierce. That's still to come after the latest news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For 6 weeks now, Nigeria's president has been missing in action. President Yar'Adua is believed to be receiving treatment for a heart condition in Saudi Arabia. But with the entire population in the dark about his health, rumors have been rife, and there's fear a power vacuum could be dangerous in a country which only recently turned its back on years of coups and upheavals. And the crisis comes at a time when Nigeria could use strong leadership as citizens learn one of their own allegedly tried to blow up a U.S. airliner. So the BBC's Will Ross reports several legal challenges are underway to force the president to hand over power.
It is at times lively at the Federal High Court in Abuja.
We can do that, but there's nothing personal, sir. There's nothing personal. We're talking law.
The few rows of wooden benches are packed with mostly men in smart suits wearing grey wigs. This is where the unease over President Umaru Musa Yar'Adua's absence has reached. Having not seen or heard from or of him for more than 6 weeks, some people are saying enough is enough.
All this problem, this aggro, problems we are going through today, we don't need it.
Oluwarotimi Akeredolu is the head of Nigeria's Bar Association, which is calling for the president to hand over power. He points to the example of when the former US President George Bush signed over power for just 2 hours when he underwent a medical procedure. It's a very different picture here in Nigeria, and as some tasks can only be carried out by the president, Mr. Akeredolu says it's time for Goodluck Jonathan, the current vice president or VP, to take over.
Mr. President, it is only your doctors that will determine whether or not you are strong enough to continue to be in office.
President Yar'Adua's poor health should not have come as a great surprise. When he was pushed forward as the ruling party's candidate for the 2007 election, his health was already an issue. Suffering from a kidney problem for years, he'd flown out for treatment abroad at the height of the campaigning. 3.5 years later, and the president's health is causing increased anxiety here. Outside a supermarket in Abuja, there's a big sign. At last, a champagne you can drink without feeling guilty. But few of the shoppers sounded like they had much to celebrate. Most had had enough of the secrecy surrounding their absent president's health or even his whereabouts.
Oh, yes, it's been worrying every Nigerian. I think the right thing to do is to hand over to the next person, which is the vice president.
And do you think the fact that he's not here, do you think it affects the way the country is run?
Yes, it does. For instance, let's take this terror, Abdul Muttalib or whatever his name is. This is where diplomacy comes into place. We should have a president that should be able to liaise with other people, but we don't have that, only our minister talking.
Why do you think that the truth is not able to be presented to the people?
It could be that there are some people that are benefiting from his absence. You know, it's all politics, really. But we don't care. Let's just have a president. I don't care where he's from. Let's just have a president.
I headed off to meet Nigeria's foreign minister, Ojo Madueke. Although there's never been any concrete proof, President Yar'Adua is believed to have been undergoing treatment in a hospital in Saudi Arabia. When I asked for the latest news, the foreign minister told me, as far as he could tell, the president was in hospital, was conscious, and was on the mend.
Those who are around him give us a very optimistic assessment.
That he's getting better?
Yes, getting better.
Has he spoken to you at all since he left the country?
I have not made a request to speak to him.
In his role as a litigant.
Back at Abuja's Federal High Court, and yet another case was being filed in an attempt to force the president to hand over power. Human rights lawyer Femi Falana has called on the Attorney General to produce medical evidence that proves the president is capable of continuing. He says the current situation is especially dangerous, seeing as Nigeria only turned its back on military rule just over a decade ago.
Before the restoration of the current fragile democratic process, I was arrested, detained, and charged with all manners of frivolous offenses by military dictators for asking for the restoration of democracy in Nigeria. Now, if you do not resolve this crisis constitutionally, we may be playing into the hands of anti-democratic elements.
So you're worried that perhaps some military personalities might come in and say, look, there's an impasse here, there's a vacuum, let's come in and seize power.
No, that's fear is real. We want the court to intervene in the interest of political stability of the country.
That report from the BBC's Will Ross in Nigeria. We'll be back in 30 seconds with the latest news from the world of snowboarding here and now. Welcome back. America's top snowboarders are in Mammoth Lakes, California this week, taking part in trials for next month's Vancouver Olympics. Absent and missed is 22-year-old Vermonter Kevin Pierce. He's in the intensive care unit of a Salt Lake City hospital with a severe brain injury after suffering a New Year's Eve fall while attempting one of snowboarding's latest tricks. John Branch is a sports reporter for the New York Times. He's been following what we hope is Kevin's recovery. John, Kevin Pierce has been considered a top contender for one of the four top spots on the Olympic halfpipe team. How's he doing?
Well, the good news is that he just, in the last day or so, has been upgraded from critical to serious condition. They've removed the breathing tube from him, and they say he's slowly regaining consciousness. So he has been in a coma, I guess is the best way to put it, and seems to be slowly coming out of that. But he does have a long recovery ahead of him, so I think it's just one step at a time.
And we should say he was wearing his helmet. I mean, this is a serious snowboarder.
Absolutely. He was wearing a helmet. I understand he smacked his head when he came down on this trick on the side of the icy pipe there, right above the goggles, and had a big welt on his forehead. So yeah. I don't know if it ended up hitting him between the goggles and the helmet and somehow missed the helmet, or if it was just so severe that the helmet didn't do much good.
Well, Kevin is the son of Vermont glassblower Simon Pierce, who's well known up there in Keechee Gorge, Vermont. His family must be devastated.
I think they are. Just by coincidence, I was working on a story on the family and had called that day that Kevin was hurt and talked to Kevin's brother before they had any news of Kevin's accident. Everything was fine. And a couple hours later, his mom called me back, returned my call, and she was, I wouldn't say hysterical, but obviously very nervous. I could tell as soon as I picked up the phone that something was wrong.
Yeah.
And she said, John, we just heard Kevin's in a serious accident. He's been taken to the hospital. We're headed to Utah. And yeah, that's the last time I've actually spoken to her. But yeah, she was very frantic, and understandably so, now that we know what happened.
Right. Well, Kevin Pierce was attempting a double cork when he was hurt. Can you try to describe that, John, and also put it in context? Because once a new trick like this one comes along, you know, everyone has to do it. So, you know, put it in context. How hard is it? And just try to describe it.
Sure. It is kind of this season's must-have trick. It's called the double cork, and there are several variations of it. Cork stands for corkscrew, but in essence, a double cork is a double backflip with a twist. And so what they're doing is they're going up the wall, and when they take off, they do a basically double backflip while they're twisting and land back down. The reason it's difficult, well, there's lots of reasons it's difficult, but it's new this year. Sean White was really the first one to land this in competition back in August in New Zealand. And people have been working on it the last few months before that. But that kind of opened the floodgates, and everybody said, well, if that's the level we're going to be playing at this year, basically,
right,
in this Olympic year, we better do the same thing. So there's been just a rush toward trying to get this trick mastered. And Kevin Pierce was part of that rush. He's one of the guys that was practicing it, had landed it many times in practice, and was training on that trick again the last day of December.
And to put Kevin Pierce in context, he's one of the few snowboarders that's beaten Sean White.
Absolutely. He has beaten Sean a couple times in the last couple of years at the European Burton Open, last year at the X Games, where they have three runs instead of two, like you'll see at the Olympics. He was ahead of Sean White after two runs, and Sean White had a tremendous final run to barely edge out Kevin. And so going into the summer, this past summer, everyone thought it's going to be Kevin and Sean, basically. I mean, Sean's widely regarded as the best in the world, but Kevin was right there.
Well, we know this isn't the first major injury Kevin Pierce sustained. You wrote about shattering his ankle in a half-pipe crash just last year. So is this latest terrible fall making people think twice about the sport and how it should go forward. I mean, why is it that it's the trick? I mean, I suppose this applies to a lot of sports, but, you know, why is it that it's the one trick that, you know, can tell whether you're gold or silver? I mean, is there any thinking about what happens going forward?
I think there is a lot of thinking. This is obviously making them think. Some people have said this is only a matter of time. The half pipe is getting bigger and bigger. It's now a 22-foot pipe, which means it's a 22-foot wall, meaning that when the snowboarders come down, they're sliding down 22 feet across the bottom of it and going back up 22 feet. They're getting more speed. They're getting more what they call amplitude, which is basically air. And, you know, the higher they go, the faster they go, the more dangerous it becomes. And when you start adding in sort of let's keep raising the bar in terms of the difficulty of tricks, it's a recipe for, I think, more and more danger, which has always been what snowboarding's allure has been. But at some point, I think people will say, well, wait, have we gone too far?
Well, and I'm wondering how the snowboarders feel about that. We know that 21-year-old Danny Davis was on the winner's podium yesterday at the trials in Mammoth Lakes, and he held up a sign saying, Pierce be with you.
Mm-hmm.
So they obviously miss him. But if you tell a snowboarder, we got to cut off at tricks or something, how are they going to react to that?
I think just like any other athlete, especially ones that are involved in any sort of extreme kind of sport, I mean, it's like telling a skier, we're going to wax your ski so you slow down a little bit because we think it's too dangerous. I mean, they're in that business, and that's what got them into that business is their love for that kind of thing. There's always been an element of danger in it. Those guys love it, and for the most part, it's a young group. I think most of them think that they're indestructible, because they start snowboarding and start doing these tricks when they're teenagers. I just think it's part of the culture. It's part of the risk that's involved, and you just kind of hope it doesn't happen to you. And I've talked to Jake Burton about this, the founder of Burton Snowboards. He's somewhat regarded as kind of a godfather of the snowboarding world. Jake's thought is that, yeah, we're probably going to have to start looking at how far we go in terms of the danger, but I don't think there's a whole lot that will hold it back. 22-foot half pipes, which are now, they're basically called super pipes, but they're pretty much the norm now for Olympic-style competitions. I'm not sure how much bigger you can get. Just a few years ago, they used mostly 18-foot half pipes. I'm not sure how much bigger you can get. But there is talk about, is there a way to make the deck, the flat part at the top of the pipe, somehow pad that or somehow make that less dangerous? And right now, it's just it's a flat piece of ice. If you land on that, which Kevin did when he hurt his ankle, that's obviously very dangerous.
Boy, I would say pad that deck.
Yeah.
I would start there. John Branch, sports reporter for the New York Times, with the latest on snowboarder Kevin Pierce. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Time now for a few quick news notes, and one is from the world of sports. Washington Wizards player Gilbert Arenas has been indefinitely suspended without pay for bringing guns into the Wizards locker room and pulling them out in an argument. NBA Commissioner David Stern had planned to wait to take action while federal and local authorities investigate, but after seeing a photo in which Arenas posed with his teammates, pointing his index fingers as if they were guns, Stern said he got tired of his antics. Now Arenas will lose nearly $150,000 for every game he misses during suspension. He said in a statement that he brought unloaded guns to the locker room as part of a misguided joke. He called Stern to apologize. In other news, the Census Bureau is adding the word Negro in addition to African American and Black to 2010 forms. Some people are outraged, associating the world with the Jim Crow South, but the Bureau says it's just trying to get an accurate count of minorities. CBS reports some older Americans requested the word, so the Bureau decided to include it. Well, before we go today, back to the future. Where's my flying car? You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to the future. Remember the end of that 1985 film when Marty McFly, his girlfriend Jennifer, and Doc Brown all jump into that souped-up DeLorean for a trip to the future. Marty, played by Michael J. Fox, thinks they might not get up to speed.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough roads to get up to 88.
Roads? Well, we're going. We don't need roads.
So they all fly off way into the future to 2015. So much for that prophecy. 2015 is just a few years away now, and I think we're still going to need roads. But whatever happened to flying cars, or for that matter, hovercraft or jetpacks? What happened to that prediction in 1967 that we'd be regenerating limbs by the 1980s, or that we'd cure the cold, have a shot that prevented cavities, a pill to make us smarter, or end alcoholism? Journalist and author Paul Milo takes a look at predictions in his fascinating new book, Your Flying Car Awaits, Robot Butlers, Lunar Vacations, and Other Dead Wrong Predictions of the 20th Century. Paul joins us from the Argo Network studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
And why didn't the flying car get off the ground? Because as you write, people thought, hey, we can do an airplane, we can do a car. Why not a flying car?
The problem is probably what a lot of people would expect. More logistics than the actual technological challenge of right. building a flying car. You'd need a lot more air traffic controllers, and it'd be a lot more difficult to have 18-year-old kids getting their license after just 2 or 3 weeks of driving school if everybody's piloting flying cars.
Right, it's a little harder to learn how to be a pilot than to drive a car.
Yeah, I would have a tough time with it.
Well, then you make the point. I mean, first of all, who wants everybody zipping around up there? It's as dangerous as it is down here, and we'd have to rip out all the infrastructure. So you kind of point out that a lot of invention hasn't happened because people, we don't really want it.
Right, right. You know, the moon landing was the kind of thing where it wouldn't naturally happen unless a lot of people wanted it to happen and a lot of money was spent. But it's not the type of thing that just would have spontaneously occurred. Right. The flying car is along those lines. You would need kind of like a moonshot type effort.
Right. You remind us, too, another example. After we learned how to seed clouds, by the way, something that was discovered by Kurt Vonnegut's brother, Bernard.
Yes.
I forgot that.
Yes.
It was predicted a little later in 1945 that we would schedule weather like the trains. You know, it would just be just like you stop and start trains, you'd stop and start weather. But this is another one where people decided, man, that's not such a good idea.
Because they were discovering that you can't control this as finely as you would like. And sometimes it just wasn't as effective as advertised, too.
Didn't you point out that the U.S. actually did manipulate weather? I think, was it in Vietnam?
It was during the Vietnam War, right?
Right.
And that's actually what I was just alluding to. The plan back then was to seed the clouds to extend the rainy season so the North Vietnamese could no longer use the trails to infiltrate South Vietnam. And it's one of those ideas that looks pretty neat on paper, but the problem is they weren't sure if they would be able to make the rainy season stop once they extended it.
Right. So now the U.S. and other countries have signed a treaty banning weather manipulation as a weapon of war, which probably
right.
seems like a good idea. So things that seem like a good idea then become maybe not so good ideas. But what about the ones where, you know, moral questions are raised? A number of predictions about how the human race would be improved by the 21st century. You have geneticists. Is it J.B.S. Haldane?
Yes.
Saying that babies right. would be grown in an artificial growth medium.
Right. They considered pregnancy, the act of giving birth, as just one more difficulty? Problem? I mean, really, that seemed to be the attitude. A medical problem that science could, quote unquote, cure. This was a time of much higher infant mortality rates, a time of much higher maternal mortality rates, you know, during childbirth. So I think the idea was, well, gee, let's take the danger out of the equation and just make people with the added attraction of making them perfect.
Or making them better. I'm thinking of the smart pill.
That's a funny one. The research, as it turned out, couldn't be replicated. But there were experiments at the University of Michigan in the 1960s in which a type of worm called a planarian was trained to avoid an electric shock. And then it appeared as though when an untrained worm ate them, the untrained worm then learned also how to avoid an electric shock. In other words, it's like the worm ate the knowledge.
Right. That's so wild.
It is. We kind of have something like intelligence boosters. I mean, some of the pills that – or some of the medications, rather, for things like ADD do help your concentration. But they were thinking that you could actually somehow get high school French – in a caplet.
Well, you could teach French to the worm and then eat the worm. But somehow, somehow knowledge was passed along that way. What's your favorite after you've finished, after all is said and done?
One of the ones that fascinated me the most was the video telephone. And this has been a staple in sci-fi forever. This one appealed to me because it was kind of logical. It made a lot of sense for that to happen. And yet it didn't because people really didn't want it. I mean, people didn't always want to be able to see one another when they were talking on the telephone.
Exactly. I'm thinking half the time I answer the phone.
Right. Well, think about it. I mean, you know, you're in your bathrobe. I mean, you're calling out sick from work.
Well, so that's another example of one where the technology was there, but just the wherewithal wasn't. And that reminds me, one of our favorites was the idea of a computerized traffic management system. This is the idea that all steering, braking, acceleration would be done by remote control, by traffic organizers somewhere else. And they actually had an experiment in 1997 in Southern California. They blocked off a section of road. They had these modified Hondas and Buicks on I-15 in San Diego, all of them handled by this computerized system.
Right.
And they were able to handle twice as many cars. Anybody who's been on I-15 in San Diego knows it can be rough. They had twice as many cars on that road during the demonstration. Apparently, other people, computers, can drive us better than we can. Why did that go nowhere? The budget was canceled soon after.
Again, I mean, great idea, but it would require a concerted effort by a lot of people, and it would require a significant financial investment, too. What's interesting about the self-driving car, though, is that we might get there, but in a way that's different from what was originally envisioned. They kind of thought that we'd have a central control where a radio tower is beaming instructions to individual cars. I think what's happening, though, is that we're getting to the point where the cars will have the brains to drive themselves, each individual car, and they'll have the brains to avoid colliding with each other. I mean, at this point, there are cars that can parallel park by themselves.
Right.
I mean, these are marketable. That's not sci-fi. If you've got the means, you can buy a car like this.
Well, and I think there are already some cars that'll tell you when you're too close.
You've got, you know, the collision avoidance, and you've got GPS systems.
I'm reminded, too, as far as the self-driving car goes, at least recently, we've had some incidents where that might not be such a good idea. I'm thinking of the two GPS incidents where people were taken, you know, into snow and into, you know, off-roads.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, some people might be thinking, I'm not sure I want my car to drive for me.
I guess if they throw in an override, like a big red button that you could press and you can take over for the computer. If
like
the computer
on your treadmill.
Gets all... Right. If you think about it, though, I mean, driving is the most dangerous thing we all do every day. And I don't know if the computers at this point could do much worse.
Huh.
I think, personally, within 15 or 20 years, it's my opinion, we'll have a car that drives itself. It just won't be quite the way they thought back in the 30s or, for that matter, in the 90s. But as advertised, it will be able to drive itself.
Well, Paul Milo, we'll check back with you in 15 years to see if you're one of the predictors whose prediction actually does come true. His book is Your Flying Car Awaits, Robot Butlers, Lunar Vacations, and Other Dead Wrong Predictions of the 20th Century. Paul Milo, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.